Riddle me this. How do you give 900 students an online exam all at once and make sure they don't cheat?
You put them in separate rooms somewhere.
Does it involve the blockchain?
Neither of those things. No. In fact, you put as many of them as possible in the same room.
With the blockchain?
Blockchain optional.
Is the blockchain in the room with us?
So I got to find out the answer to this question while I was at Moodle Moot Duck, which I mentioned in the previous episode. And one of the evening activities was a tour of ETH Zurich's online exam centre.
Is that ETH like ETH, you know, that's on the blockchain?
Someone hasn't listened to last week's episode.
We've done that joke.
Oh, bother. Also, yes, haven't listened yet.
So this was a pretty cool setup to see. So we went into this unassuming looking university building. We all crowded into quite a small lobby, which we were assured they don't make the students do when it's raining, because they'd all get crushed as they try and get through from a very small room into a very large room in the rain.
Is this Zurich University lobby area that you were entering?
Yes, I was entering the lobby area.
Okay.
Not the lobby area.
And then we went through into what was apparently originally a small theatre space, but has since been converted for this purpose. And converting it involved adding quite a lot of extra cooling, because what they had in this room was about 450 desks with computers at, all lined up in rows with dividers in between.
Is this the photo that you've posted to us that has like little like alcoves with each computer in a little like small confined space?
Office cubicles from hell.
Yeah, the worst possible office space. Yeah.
It was quite funny actually, because we all walked in and everyone was going, "Oh wow, look at this." And they said, "Strange, a lot of people say this feels really dystopian."
I'm conjuring up memories of working in a 90s IT organization in America where it was just like Raiders of the Lost Ark end sequence, but of cubes of computer terminals where people went to die every day.
It goes on for much further into the distance than that.
Yeah. So, yeah, this was about... I think probably just under half of their capacity in one room. This was the biggest room. And then they have a few others around the site where they can do smaller groups, or they can do, if they need to, up to 900 students at once. So you don't have to have the risk of having multiple cohorts where you have some start it and then they finish and they have to be kept separate from the next cohort who come in and do it. They've managed to scale it up enough. But the way all of this is set up is each of these cubicles has a desk and a monitor and a little thin client PC, all very neatly done. You can't see any cables trailing around, all really nicely put together. But then these were all managed centrally. So once they'd showed us the floor, they took us up to a mezzanine level where you could see over the whole room. And the guy who was giving us the tour opened up his laptop where he had a floor plan of the room. And he selected a bank of computers and hit boot. And you could see the ones he'd selected all come on and they booted up to an initial bootloader. And then they did a boot into a remote desktop, which was the configuration which had been set up. Apparently, you can have two configurations set up at a time. So this was the configuration for this test exam they were doing for us. And you got to watch over a few minutes as it did all of the gubbins and logged into this remote desktop. And then you went down and it was a sort of kiosk mode. There's a web browser called Safe Exam Browser, exactly for this purpose, which just lets you go to a particular Moodle site or Moodle quiz with a particular configuration, and it checks that your computer is in that configuration and nothing else. So you just get this kiosk mode web browser with your Moodle quiz in. And then we sat down and we pretended to be students for half an hour.
Is this browser like any more kiosky than a kiosk web browser? Is it specially adapted to be anti-cheat in some way?
I mean, it's basically that it has this, it's not just that it's locked down. When it starts up, it will also do configuration checks and it'll only let you go to a certain page.
Right.
They do have, in this setup, they can be less locked down than the demo they gave us. They can also, because some exams, you know, you want to have other applications available and they can do that. Or they might, it might be a essentially the digital equivalent of an open book exam where they can go online and do other things. But this was like the fully locked down experience that they gave us.
And what operating system was booted?
Now, unfortunately, this has to be Windows because Safe Exam Browser doesn't run on Linux yet.
Right.
So, but it was booting into Moodle, which is why I thought it was a cool thing to be talking about, because that's how they do all of their exams in this setup, which was very cool. As well as this, they have remote monitoring and recording of each session. So if you're standing up on this mezzanine looking down and you think something suspicious is going on over there, you can bring up the desktop of the machine and see what's going on. And if anything happens afterwards, you've got full, it's not, I don't think it's like a video recording, but it's every few seconds it captures a screenshot. So if there's any dispute over what happened, if, you know, someone tells you, oh no, the system went wrong and that's why I didn't have any of my answers saved, and you can then go back and see, well, did you actually put in your answers in the first place for them not to be saved, and things like that. Very sort of well thought out, all corners covered kind of system. And the other really interesting thing about this is when you go in, you notice that all of these kiosks have quite a temporary kind of feel. They're all just sort of cut out of MDF and slotted together. And it turns out the reason for this is because they tear this whole setup down twice a year, because the other part of the year, this is used by architecture students, this space, to build big models and stuff like that.
Out of MDF?
Quite possibly. Maybe it's the same MDF. But then they have this process of rebuilding it and rewiring it all up again for the exam season, and then they tear it down again.
My goodness. I mean, this sounds like an incredible bit of like automation and IT infrastructure. Did you get the impression that this is legitimately ready to rumble all the time, or was this like a staged, they'd spent a month preparing it for the conference sort of
setup? This is very much a battle tested setup. Wow. Now, this is something which they're doing as a regular service each year for their students, which is really amazing to see. Because yeah, having sort of done the Moodle infrastructure side for some of these sorts of things, where you have hundreds of students trying to log on at once and all submit their stuff, and it all some bit getting automatically graded, and the load that puts on the servers, and then actually seeing, well, this is how they do it for real, is quite cool.
So that's an interesting thing. I didn't realize that Moodle was like an exam taking platform as well. I thought it was purely for learning content.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be if you set it up right. And I mean, it depends on your requirements for your exams, but it's got a quiz engine with all sorts of configurability and all sorts of different ways of running it. So you can use it for, you know, in class or in course, like, assessments or self-assessments or just practicing. But then you can also, in the right setup, have it be for high stakes proper qualification level exams.
Amazing. So have you like had to work on any of the sort of rush server configuration to sort of handle, you know, 900 people all hitting go at the same time in exam conditions?
Well, generally we ask that our clients let us know in advance if that's going to happen.
Right.
Because we have the ability to just scale up our infrastructure. If that needs to happen, it can happen and we can handle it. As long as we know before they press the button that we need to do it, then it's okay. But more recently, I've actually been working on ways of making some of this heavy processing load that goes on in Moodle asynchronous, because what actually makes it take a lot of load, are at the start when you click take an attempt of this quiz, there's a lot that has to go on. If you've got things like random questions selected from a pool or different versions of questions, where it has to calculate exactly what it's going to show to you individually as a student.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some work so that that can then happen in advance of the exam in the background. So right. when you're as a student click and go, all it's doing is saying, oh, that's all done, just open it up.
So there's some pre-cached stuff that it delivers.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the other end of that is when you click submit my attempt, there's all sorts of automated grading and feedback that can happen if you have it configured. And again, that can involve some quite heavy processing.
Mm.
So the other bit of work I've been doing is making it so that rather than happening during the next page load, which is also going on while everyone else is doing that page load and bogging down your front end web server, that goes into a queue.
Yeah.
And you just immediately see, okay, your assignment, your exam has been submitted. You will see your grade in a minute. And that, we've actually had a client use that in anger, and they found that they didn't need to scale up during their exam period, right, which is a quite incredible result considering what we've had in the past.
Amazing. I want to see this firsthand now. That sounds like an incredible... I mean, just looking out over all these machines.
Yeah.
When they're booted, do they all boot to like a consistent configuration, or can you like choose what exam or course you're being examined on during this boot sequence?
No. That's all controlled. So they can have two configurations available at a time. And then you say, these computers are going to boot to this configuration, and that's all they do. There's no way of you going in and faffing around with it.
Right.
When you described it as from the mezzanine floor, someone like dragging and dropping across a selection of the computers, I'm thinking Command and Conquer. Is it like that?
You can't, you know, like order them to fight each other or anything. But
a shame.
It is, you know, it's a, click the mouse, drag it over the ones you want. It selects them. You can see which ones you've selected, and you can basically say on or off.
That'll do. I have migrated yet another thing from a shonky shell script, as we call it, to this time Node.
Oh, shonky JavaScript.
Okay, that's the first opener. Why Node?
Because that's what the AI agent chose.
Okay.
And I didn't want to have an argument, so I just said... Yeah, okay, whatever. No, actually, what happened was I have a cron job that runs on an HP microserver, an aging HP microserver in my loft. And recently, in summer 2026, it's been quite warm in the UK. And that HP microserver that lives in my loft has powered itself down a few times through... overheating, and the cron job that runs on that machine only runs on that machine and then drops an HTML file in sync thing folder. And I noticed recently that that file has not been updated for a while. I wonder why that is. Ah, that's because the server has shut itself down. Now, it doesn't do a lot, this server. It's, like I say, quite old, and I've tried to migrate as much off of it as possible. And this is like the last thing that's on there.
When you say it doesn't do a lot, I think that's kind of because it can't really do a lot, right? Because of its vintage.
To be fair, yes. I've tried to run a few things on it that have actually not been able to run because the CPU is so old that some of the instructions that things are compiled for just will not run on that thing. Yeah, it's got to that age. It's not quite... Viglin MPCL AMD Geode era of thing, but it ain't far off, right? It's a CPU that has missing instructions. But that's not the problem on this particular case. It's a shell script. The problem in this particular case is that it got hot and shut down, and so that cron job doesn't run. Now, obviously, running a cron job on a random server in my loft is not a tenable solution. So I thought, well, now that it's down, it's a good time to migrate that somewhere else. Do I have a copy of that shell script anywhere other than the box that's currently shut down? No. I didn't check that shell script into GitHub at any point.
Your life is chaos.
I like a little bit of chaos in my life,
A little
Martin.
Bit. Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Not
I try
total.
And keep, I try and keep that chaos in the loft. Yes. So what I did was I re-implemented it in a way that it is a little bit more sustainable. So it's now in a GitHub repo. Yay. Like celebration, like, you know, party popper emoji at the ready. And it's also deployed to Cloudflare because that's where I deploy everything. And the idea is that it runs on a regular basis. Hourly is good enough. Now, what the script does is it goes and has a look at all the snaps that I have published in the Snap Store and looks at the upstream repositories that those snaps are built from and looks to see any that, or tries to figure out if any of them are out of date, as in there's a new version upstream. And the problem is that I don't have a whole lot of automation around the build of everything. Some of it is semi-automated, but not all of it. And so what I like to have is a dashboard that tells me, hey, Alan, you forgot about these things. These things are out of date. And so that's all it is. It's just a dashboard that tells me the version of whatever snap in the store is 1 and the version upstream is 2. You need to update it. And I used to refresh. I had it open in a tab, a pinned tab in my browser, and it's just an HTML file in a sync thing folder. But that's not really good enough. So now it's snaps.popey.com, and that is a publicly accessible list of all the snaps that I have published in the store and whether they're up to date. And that's partly to keep myself accountable for the snaps that I've taken on, but also it's a way for me to have a single pane of glass view of all the snaps and know which ones need a small amount of attention. Now, ultimately, I would love to automate all of this so that that screen is just green everywhere. but at the moment, that's not the case. But what I wanted to do is have the dashboard first. And so now I've got the dashboard, I can work on, well, which one of these needs automation? And there are, I don't know, right now, probably half a dozen or 9 or so that are requiring human attention. And that's what I need to do. And so I built this thing. It's pretty straightforward. And I use the vanilla framework, which if you've seen snapupdates.popey.com or snapcroft.io or literally any canonical website, you'll recognize this theme. And I wanted to do that because they're snaps. I thought, well, let's use the theme that Snapcroft uses and that Ubuntu uses. And so I use that theme and I just have a simple web UI that I can keep an eye on now and then.
So I've been aware you've had a facility like this for some time to stay sort of briefed on what needs action, and the vanilla framework is very clear. I've just loaded the website up and it looks like a canonical property. And I'm wondering if you're going for your like second hit here, in that you're suggesting that maybe having a personalized status screen within Snapcraft.io as a what do I need to do, what needs updating, might be the next facility you sort of osmosis into the Snapcraft ecosystem.
So I think what you're referring to is, in a previous episode, I mentioned snapupdates.popey.com, where Mark Shuttleworth put the screenshot on screen. And now, if you go to snapcraft.io, there is a banner that shows you how many snaps are in the store. And I can 100% take credit for that being there, because it was very clear that they stole that. Sorry. It were inspired by.
Yes.
I don't think so. I think it might be useful to people who maintain multiple snaps. And I've tried to make tools that are useful to me and useful to other weirdos like me who publish multiple snaps. And so I think there's a small audience for this. People like Ken Van Dyne, who has a whole bunch of snaps published in the store. And there's a few other people.
Prolific snap crafters that have got dozens. Get a little
bit
dozens.
Obsessed about YAML files. Yeah. and so, yes, there's a small audience for this. And so it's open source. If you go to my GitHub repo, you'll find the source code there. And you could clone it and change the config to only reference the snaps that you maintain. That's fine. So it's a very small audience for this. It's the smallest possible audience. It's just for me, basically. But if someone else wants to use it, it's open source. I'll MIT license it and anyone can use it.
I have found a terminal multiplexer that I like and I've actually started using. So following on from all the way back in episode 43, where I talked about a tool called Pew, which I queued up as my, I don't need a terminal multiplexer because I put long running processes into Pew.
How's that going?
I've had a complete, turnaround on that now.
Very uncharacteristic of you.
Yeah, of all of us.
I like to keep evolving the way that I work and all the rest of it. And I don't think that I've been sleeping on terminal multiplexers, because I have tried them all over the years and they're all rubbish. But I have found one that advertised one singular feature that made me try it, but its design is impeccable, and it doesn't actually matter if this one particular feature that teased me in is what you're interested in. It's just a really great design for a terminal multiplexer. Now, it's called Herder, and that's with a closed R at the end. So it's got lots of 2010 Flickr and Tumblr energy going on in the naming, but everything else about it is very contemporary and modern day.
So what's wrong with TMUX and Screen and that other one that I can never remember?
Zellige.
That's the one, Zellige.
So Screen just doesn't work. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff it doesn't do. It doesn't support a whole bunch of sort of expectations of what a terminal needs to do. So we'll just park that one. If you're using Screen, I'm sorry, it's awful. TMUX is the least worst of the other two, in my opinion. It's actually quite decent. And I do like it. I just never saw the point, because it just didn't speak to me. I was able to run the processes, long-running processes, remotely with Pure or other tools like that. And for all of the other stuff, I've got local window managers, tiling window managers, terminals with tabs and all the rest of it. I just didn't need all of that extra baggage and extra key commands to work. And Zellige, I know, has a strong following, and it's got all sorts of clever, like, terminal painting and all the rest of it. And again, it didn't speak to me, because I've got all of that in my terminal emulators already, and it's just another bunch of cruft. And a bit like Screen, it's totally broken in a number of ways that terminals expect to work, and that's rubbish. So having tried but bounced off the terminal emulators over the years, I'd kind of written them off. But there was one that passed me by a few weeks, about a month ago now, and I said it's called Herder. And the principal feature that hooked me in is it said it was agent aware, which means it can report and acknowledge the status of things like Claude Code and Codex, or if you're using your own self-hosted models, things like PyAgent and OpenCode. And as I use increasingly sort of AI-assisted development flows, I thought that would be kind of a useful thing to have in my terminal workflow, because I want to be notified of when tasks have completed and all that sort of thing. And I was trying to run multiple like research projects at the same time and maximize my sort of time efficiency, instead of just sort of waiting around, twiddling my thumbs, waiting for things to finish, sort of start a research project in one task and then move on to a research project in another. So you have things going in parallel. But doing that with desktop workspaces and terminal tabs, it gets really cluttered really quickly, and it was quite frustrating. It's like trying to build a Lego set when you're five and you haven't got the instructions, and you're just sort of vibrating with frustration at not being able to complete the thing.
I've seen you vibrate with frustration, and it's not a pretty sight. So I'm pleased to hear that you found the terminal multiplexer of, you know, value to you.
And while that agentic integration was the thing that hooked me in, I think this is just a really great design. So I'm now going to talk about all of the other things it does and how it's laid out that I find really appealing, that I think anyone else that is working on projects with Git, multiple projects, will really appreciate. The first thing is that the design is really opinionated and quite straightforward. So I'm going to have to describe a visual thing in a podcast, which is never great. But down the left-hand side of the screen is a list of all of your projects. So you can just add basically a directory with a Git repo in it, and that's a project. And the first thing that Herder does is it understands Git. So it can show you how forward or behind you are in Git with simple glyphs just alongside each of the project names. So that's immediately a win, because you can see, you know, what's up to date and what's behind and what you're currently, you know, working on. But then each project then has a series of tabs. And you can think of those as like browser tabs that spread horizontally across the top. So these are tabs per project. And these are saved. And the herder daemon that runs in the background manages all of this layout for you. And it's persistent. And it's persistent across reboots as well, which is really terrific. So what I've started to do is I have my first tab, which is whatever AI agent I might be using for research. And then the next tab, always open, is LazyGit peering into that project. And then the next tab is GH Dash. So GH is the GitHub utility, and Dash is like this amazing dashboard extension for GH, which means you can stay on top of per project GitHub notifications, pull requests, and issues, and it's focused on that particular task. And then I have, calling back to another previous episode, the Fresh Editor open.
I had a feeling that was coming along.
Inside that project. Yeah, and so it goes, right? And so, and then I just have a shell open in that project, and these are all in tabs.
So you were saying that things like Screen and Tmux have issues, or things that we're expecting to run Eternal have issues running in those. What is it that's different about Herder? Do they solve those problems somehow?
Yeah, I found no compatibility issues with any of the modern day, you know, what we call modern Unix utilities that do clever things in a multiplexer. All of that stuff just works. So although each of these tabs is, you know, multiplexed in some way, it just works as if it's in a terminal in the normal way. I haven't experienced any weird compatibility issues. And it goes quite deep on the integration. So you can connect to a remote herder. So if you've configured herder on a home server in your loft, for example, and you're at work and you've configured Tailscale or some other VPN, you can connect from your laptop to your, you know, central herder with all of your work, and you just have this persistent workspace. Wherever you go, it's always there.
Now, to be fair, you could do the same thing with like Mosh into my home server or SSH into my home server, and then running Tmux or Biobu or Screen or whatever. So you can achieve a similar result. I think a good concrete example where Mark was asking, what does Herder do that Tmux can't? I'll give you a really basic, simple example: scrolling.
Right.
If you open a terminal, a new terminal in Tmux, and there's a lengthy history of stuff going on,
yeah,
scrolling is like control A, square bracket, page up, and it's horrible.
Yeah.
Whereas in Herder, it's like any terminal. It's like a nested terminal inside a frame, and you could just scroll with your mouse wheel or your touchpad or whatever, and it works. And I think that, for me, I've tried Herder as well, and that was just the clincher, is the scrolling. Yeah.
And you mentioned mouse wheels there. Everything in Herder is mouse activated. So every tab, and things like right-clicking on tabs to rename them, or clicking the plus to add a new one, or adding a new project, or dragging the sidebar to resize. It works like a graphical application, but it's in the terminal, and you just don't feel any friction. If you want to do it with the keyboard, you can. It uses the same key bindings as Tmux. So if you've been using Tmux, you can switch to Herder, and I think it even migrates your Tmux configuration into Herder if you've got one.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you've abandoned Herder for and replaced it with next week.
I don't know I'm going to abandon it. I feel like I've identified something that I can't do in this very terminal interface that I am working on solving. And maybe in a future episode, I'll have something to share about that.
I've seen it. Subscribe. You need to subscribe.